Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitted across the internet, this is episode 340 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. Did your air conditioning get fixed?
It did indeed.
Did you say the guy was literally as old as Methuselah?
He wouldn't have been much less than Methuselah. He was older than I am as far as his appearance, but I think in reality he was not as old as I am, but the years haven't been good to him.
Because, no offense, Larry, you look pretty old.
Yeah, but he made me look younger.
Wow, that's pretty rough. I think we have an unusual episode this evening. Do you want to tell us what we're doing?
Well, we didn't have any major cases that came up on my radar, so I picked some articles that I thought may be of interest to the PFR community. Some of them are directly on point, and some of them, of the four, there's some that are a little bit less on point, but for those who have in-depth analytical skills, they'll be able to possibly figure out why I put at least one article in here. But yes, that's all we have. And then if time permits, if we go through these too fast, we can talk about an attempt to scam a PFR here in Albuquerque last week.
All right. Well, first of all, you put this one in here from Courthouse News, and it says Kentucky law banning some PFRs from using aliases on social media sites does not violate the First Amendment. A county attorney from the Commonwealth of Kentucky argued Wednesday before an appeals court panel. Wait, this does sound kind of familiar, though.
It does indeed sound very familiar. This seems to be a fad around the country that they don't want PFRs having full access to the internet. But Kentucky Senate Bill 249 requires people convicted of a PFR-type crime involving a minor to use their full legal names on all social media platforms. Directly from the article, the Republican legislature passed a bill which was signed into law by Democratic Governor Andy Beshear in 2024.
And what's one such offender claim the law violates his First Amendment right to anonymous speech and is overly broad? Do you think that this is a good challenge?
I've learned to be more cautious after the Cornelio case out of Connecticut, but it's not one that would have resonated with me had the person contacted me first. But according to the argument, to the article, it's an argument that's held significant weight. And it held weight with the U.S. District Judge Greg Stivers. And he was an appointee by that communist Barack Obama.
I've heard people call him a communist before. I've heard this.
Yes, but in addition, there are some appellate-level decisions that have proclaimed the practice unconstitutional. One was, I just mentioned, James Cornelio from Connecticut, and I told him the same thing when he reached out to us. I wasn't warm to his case, and ultimately his case was successful, so I got to be careful. I might be wrong.
It says, although the anonymous plaintiff who filed the lawsuit in federal court was denied class certification, Stivers granted his request for an injunction. The narrow relief granted to plaintiff John Doe prevented enforcement of the law only in Davies County and did not apply to any other convicted PFRs in the state. I'm guessing that Kentucky is defending the law?
They are indeed, and that's their job. I would caution people not to get too mad about the law being defended. When you put your hand on the Bible, you know, we criticize people. They take an oath to defend the laws of the United States and of the state. So, but Attorney Jeff Hayburn, who's the principal duty solicitor general of Kentucky, and I've never heard of principal duty, but I guess that means something, argued wins before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals on behalf of Davies County. And what's this, John Burlow? Where'd that come from? Anyway, Hayburn pointed out the challenge made by Doe was a facial one that required him to establish a burden on the speech of non-parties. And that's very legalistic, but a facial challenge means that you're challenging on behalf of others. You're saying there are no set of circumstances. And that's a heavy lift to say something is facially unconstitutional.
I mean, I thought that you had a right to be anonymous, though, that you could go make your account say, you know, dumaflotch102@gmail.com, and you don't have to release what your real name is.
Well, but maybe under narrowly tailored circumstances, you know, you've heard me say for years that if you narrowly tailor something, you can do almost anything.
And the example would be that you used that, not that alias, but used an alias to then do naughty things that got you in trouble. And perhaps that's the narrow tailoring.
Well, that might be a little too narrow, but yes, with proper tailoring, I think this might withstand constitutional muster.
Based on the article, U.S. Circuit Judge Eric Murphy, a Donald Trump appointee, cited the 2017 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Packingham versus North Carolina, in which the court struck down the state's social media ban for all PFRs. Is there a First Amendment right to use social media? Murphy asked.
Well, he did ask that, but keep in mind this situation is very easily distinguishable from Packingham. Packingham was a total ban on social media, where the balance of the government's interest and the burden of speech was way out of whack. That's what Haybert answered, and he went on to say there's significant interest here to protect children in this ever-evolving internet age. So this is not the same, so let's don't get ourselves too, what is it, Alan Greenspan said, overly exuberant, irrationally exuberant, because this is not the same type of challenge as Packingham was.
So then Judge Murphy stated, everyone agrees that's important, but doesn't the law need to be tailored?
And he's correct. Judge Murphy is correct. But the state agreed and emphasized that the law only applies to people convicted of PFR-type crimes involving minors. And that's their position, and that's the narrow tailoring. He said they don't have to use their legal name as their username and can simply include it in their user profile. So that means that There's some flexibility there. If it's in your profile, who reads the entire profile of someone?
Probably someone like you, I would imagine. So then, moving along, attorney Guy Hamilton Smith from Washington, D.C., argued on behalf of John Doe and took issue with that interpretation. Senate Bill 249 is a categorical ban on one category of protected speech. The facial analysis is very straightforward, he told the court. It simply imposes massive burdens on PFRs, and our over-breath argument assumes injuries to third parties. And what do you think about that?
Well, are you familiar with that name, Guy Hamilton Smith? It rings a bell.
I've heard of him. We may have had him on the show at least once, if not twice.
So, well, what I think is he's going further than what I would have felt comfortable going had I been in that courtroom, because to say that he's saying that the people that are not involved in litigation he's wishing that we're involved because he's saying it's facially unconstitutional. He's saying that we're assuming injuries to third parties. I don't think that in First Amendment jurisprudence we assume injuries to third parties. Now, Guy has a law degree and I don't, but I'm not sure that we can assume injuries to non-named parties. So that's my thoughts. But anyway, Judge Murphy asked about the offender's ability to include their legal names only within their user profile, but Hamilton Smith quickly dismissed that idea. It's a distinction without difference, he said. On social media, people click through the profile and there it is. Is that true? Do you click through every profile and see there it is?
No, I do not. But I am the non-social media person to begin with. I don't really find a lot of value in it.
So Hamilton Smith reiterated his client's First Amendment protections were spelled out in the Packingham decision, in which the court had free speech rights apply to the modern town square. This is like social media. The First Amendment safeguards choice. By not speaking on a certain day, PFRs don't forfeit their First Amendment's right to speak. I'm thinking he's a little bit on thin ice, but we'll see.
Judge Stivers, the federal judge who issued the initial injunction, honed in on free speech in his opinion. Kentucky may criminalize the use of social media platforms to commit sexual and enticement crimes against minors, but may only do so consistent with the First Amendment. And okay, so that's some legal babble there. What do you say about that?
Well, I'm going to let Hamilton Smith answer. He said He argued requiring Doe and other persons on the Kentucky PFR registry to use their full names for all communications on social media platforms impermissibly infringes upon their First Amendment rights because the law mandates the use of their full legal name for all communications on these forms, not just the targeted danger, and such conduct is also prohibited by other statutes. He's right that it's already against the law to do these things to minors, but that's not what's in the challenge here. The challenge has to do with having to disclose your name in this somewhat narrowly tailored group of PFRs who've committed crimes against minors. So I think he's stretching, but we'll see.
Hamilton Smith asked the court to expand the scope of the injunction granted by Stivers to include all of Kentucky, pointing out that his client could be arrested if he violates the law outside of Daviess County. Do you think they would extend it?
I'm thinking that they will not. In his rebuttal, Habern, the attorney for the state, requested that the injunction be vacated and defended the law as exceptionally important and narrowly tailored. I don't agree that it's exceptionally important, and I don't agree that it's really narrowly tailored, but it's somewhat tailored. So I think he kind of overplayed his hand as well.
The article states, Senior U.S. Circuit Judge Julia Smith Gibbons and Senior U.S. Circuit Judge Helene White, both George W. Bush appointees, also sat on the panel. How large was this panel?
It's a three-judge panel. When you go up on appellate review at the first level, it's usually a three-judge panel. And then if you don't like what the panel decides, then you ask for en banc review, which gets the entire circuit if they grant full court review. And then the next step is the cert petition to U.S. Supreme Court.
When do you think that we will hear back on this?
Well, the court, of course, didn't set a timetable, but there is no timetable. They'll decide when they decide, and it could linger for some time.
Can we dig around for this in this just a minute? So you can make up Mr. Jingles, whatever username you want to, but somewhere in your profile, you have to say, I am Mr. Jingles and I am Andy whatever.
That's what it appears to have said in the article.
Does that make it sufficiently, like, I mean, can you run around and then go bash your favorite hated politician, be it Marjorie Taylor Greene or, I don't know, Nancy Pelosi, take your pick. They can then still fairly easily track you down and you don't have the ability to just remain anonymous.
Oh, I totally understand where you're coming from. And I think additional narrow tailoring would have been preferable than no more tailoring that they did. But the fact that they did some narrow tailoring by not applying it to everybody like was done in Packingham, I think there's a strong risk that may be sufficient. But, you know, time will tell.
Tell me what the negative impact is. Is there, since this is already in place, if they lose, it just sets precedent that you can't challenge this for some period of time without something new and earth-shattering.
Well, it was certainly for it would green light every state in the Sixth Circuit that they can expand their internet limitations, but it would also set up a cert petition to the Supreme Court because there's conflicting decisions amongst the circuits. And so this would be one where we would very carefully look at on the NARSL side, whether we'd want to get involved in it, because this would be contrary to like the Cordelia case.
I see. Huh. Do you want to even speculate what the Supreme Court would say?
Gosh, that would be a long, hard one to do, but they've been fairly consistent on protection of speech. I'd like to think they would come down on the side of PFRs, but I'm not convinced that they would.
Well, very well. Let's move over to the very ultra-liberal rag called the Associated Press. Just for the record, the Associated Press is like just a smidge left of center and listed as like one of the most accurate sources of information available. And then, so what do we got? We have this article from the Left Coast, and it says, a debate over whether to create harsher penalties for soliciting and buying naughty behavior from 16 and 17-year-olds exploded in the California legislature this week. Republicans and some moderate Democrats were pushing for a new tool to help law enforcement go after those who sold older minors for naughty behavior. But some said they worried the measure could be misused and weaponized by parents upset about interracial or LGBTQ relationships to target older teens involved in relationships. I know how you feel about this. Now, have you referred to such laws as solicitation in search of a problem?
Yes, and I think you meant solicit older minors, not sold above there. But yes, I have referred to this as a solution in search of a problem because there are very few incidents of adults actually soliciting real minors for sex online. It's just such a rarity. But the issue came to head Thursday after Republicans in the assembly argued for the policy on the floor. Democrats overwhelmingly rejected the effort, but vowed to bring a new proposal to address the imaginary issue.
Now, there is some merit to your argument. The article states, under current law, contacting a person under 18 to engage in naughty behavior in California is already a felony. So are crimes like soliciting a child who is a victim of human trafficking, sexting a minor, engaging in sex with a minor, if the age gap between the parties is more than 3 years? That's like Romeo and Juliet kind of laws, right?
Right, precisely. And as the article points out, it's also a serious crime in California to traffic minors. Anyone convicted of at least three serious felonies in California faces a sentence of between 25 years and life under their three strikes law. In addition, California leads the nation with some of the toughest laws against trafficking. This was quoted from Assembly Speaker Robert Rivas, a liberal pointy-headed communist sympathizer.
We need McCarthy back for those guys. Now, do you have any idea what the actual problem is?
Well, according to the article, those who are 16 or 17 years old were not included in a bipartisan legislation signed last year by Governor Newsom dealing with sexual trafficking. The law, which took effect this year, allows prosecutors to charge those who solicit or buy sex from minors 15 or younger with a felony. It left in place the existing law that permits penalty for soliciting older teens to a misdemeanor. Apparently, the issue is that we can't have any PFR offense that is only a misdemeanor. That is apparently the issue.
I see. So Assemblymember Maggie Krell, another pointy-headed person looking for the McCarthy era issues, with a background as a prosecutor, wanted to expand the law Newsom signed to include older teens. Children under 18 who are bought for sex are considered victims of human trafficking under federal law and should receive the same protection under California law, she said.
Hogwash. But she went on to say, if you're 70 years old on the street corner and an old man comes up and purchases you for sex, that's rape. That is so ridiculously absurd. Just listen to what she said. If an old man comes up to you on the corner and purchases you for sex, that's rape. Now, how can that be?
Because you're not 18 and you cannot consent to some kind of exchange in a contract and shake hands and all that.
And she says that should be treated as a felony. Now, this is coming from the person who identified as a liberal pointy head, but she's a former prosecutor. So keep in mind, the Democrat Party is not monolithic as people believe it is. Here's an example of extremely divergent views within the Democrat Party.
Why do you think that some Democrats oppose the change?
Well, Democrats on the Assembly Public Safety Committee amended Krell's bill to drop the provision that would make it a felony to solicit sex from older teens. They agreed with Krell's goal, but worried that their approach would have unintended consequences. Lee LaChapelle, I guess that's how you pronounce that, of the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking told lawmakers at a hearing that the policy could be used to target 16 and 17-year-olds who are in relationships with other minors. I don't quite understand that, how that would be used to target them, but that was a direct quote. If they're targeting other minors, wouldn't that be legal? I mean, what does she mean by that?
Yeah, I don't even know. And I did see that. So then it says, LaChapelle says they are worried about the ways the criminal legal system can be utilized by parents who are upset about interracial and LGBTQ relationships.
Now, wait. Now, you're telling me that in a state like California, there would be a single person upset about interracial and LGBTQ relationships in California, the paradise of perfection?
I have to think, Larry, that while California is considered this blue bastion, once you move outside of your major population centers, as is the rest of the country, it's got to be very rural, it's very farmy, and I bet you know, a lot of very conservative kind of mindsets kick in. Granted, I'm going to tell you a story from when I moved to Georgia, and this is a very racist story, but I was like a friend of mine, the guy I was sharing with an office with, he was very upset that his daughter was interested in dating a black kid. And he's like, Zebras date zebras. Horses date horses. I was like, are you serious, man? And this is just before the year 2000. Like, granted, that's Georgia. But that mindset is not that far removed.
Well, I agree with California does have a lot of conservative areas, in particular in the more rural parts of the state, and where a lot of agriculture is dominant. So yes, that would be true. But the proponents argue the law should treat all sex predators who solicit minors the same as a felony, regardless of the intended victim's age. That, again, is hogwash. Because a 17-year-old is much better equipped to evaluate what he or she wants to do with his or her body.
Hey, Larry, a hypothetical, like some little brain exercise. People don't mentally mature at the same rate. Do you see a world where there is ever a way to more objectively measure someone's maturity and give them autonomy? I guess that's a word that we could use to describe that. Just because you turn 18, you are literally only one day older than you were yesterday when you were 17. And all of a sudden, all these rights and privileges are bestowed upon you just because of that one day difference. Whereas you could have a very, very, very young, emotionally, intellectually individual who will not become, quote unquote, of age until they're well into their 20s and be cognizant of their actions. Do you ever see a world where we could figure out a different way to do it than just say 18, you're legit? Because you could be 15 and be very, very savvy about the world.
I get your argument. I don't see that happening because we have to, it would be highly subjective. It's like this guy that used to be a leading advocate in New Mexico. He wanted us to have a speed limit that was, speed would be judged by conditions. I said, you realize how subjective that would be?
Sure.
Conditions are variable, and each driver's skills and the safety of their vehicle and how it handles in those conditions is variable. So to say that one driver is driving a vehicle that handles much better than another, and the driver's more experienced and got better operational skills, 50 might be okay. The same street might be safe for another driver with 50. I think you'd run into the same problem trying to figure out who would make that subjective determination and how we would do it. I don't think that ever happens.
Everyone else in the audience will get the reference, but Uncle Buck, this character in a movie, his car was very bouncy. He had terrible, terrible shocks. You could see him driving down the road, and the car is just like riding on a cloud, like on a sponge. And you would not be able to drive that car very fast. Correct. To support your claim. All right, well then, what happens next?
Well, several moderate Democrats, including Krill, broke with their party. So folks, listen, I had a listener here a few months ago say that I wish the Republicans stick together like Democrats do. The Democrats don't stick together. But they broke with their party to vote with the Republicans. And they did that because of political necessity. Their districts probably are swing districts, as we refer to them. And it could easily elect a Republican the next time around. So they did what they felt they needed to do. But Democrats instead backed an amendment saying that they plan to adopt the strongest laws to protect 16 and 70-year-old victims. Assembly member Nick Schultz, who chairs the Public Safety Committee, said he's committed to bringing a new proposal on the issue forward sometime this year.
And what do you imagine will happen in this particular situation?
The proponents and the victims apparatus will ultimately win. They will get their felony. We will have more felony sexual offenders in prison for behavior that just a few years ago was considered very minor criminal behavior. And we will have more dysfunctional people. We will have more people who are tax burden on society. And we won't have a clue why this is happening. But that's what I predict. You know, we don't seem to get a clue about things we do and the unintended consequences. The more people we put a felony jacket on, in particular a PFR felony, we diminish their earnings capacity dramatically.
You might be referring to do you know the website The Onion?
Yes, I've heard of it.
Well, there's an article that they keep running every time there's some kind of mass shooting. The only country in the world that can't figure out how these mass shootings are happening, has it happened to it again? Well, they just keep running the exact same article, and they scratch out the last date that it happened, and they post the new date.
Well, it's mind-boggling to me because I have very little formal education, and things that seem simple to me seem very complicated to people who have far superior educations. If we run a government where our tax system, revenue system, is geared around the individual, then we want every individual to be able to produce at their maximum capacity so they can pump as much money into that system as possible. And anything you do that will diminishes their ability to pay taxes, you're cutting down what goes into the common good pot, and you're diminishing how effectively we can pay for our wants and wishes if you put people earning one-third or one-half of what they would be truly capable of earning had they not have a felony conviction. I mean, that is not hard to understand, is it?
Not really. I know there's two people with us tonight that are earning less than they would. Three, including me, earning less than we would have otherwise.
So
I guess it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things.
Well, it should.
Well, you also then put this article, got another freaking liberal rag here, Larry, ABC News, and it says, Iowa's top prosecutor is proposing an amendment to the state's constitution to solve what one lawmaker called an interesting conundrum, weighing a person's constitutional right to confront their accuser in the courtroom against the desire to protect traumatized children and vulnerable people. Is this related to the Confrontation Clause?
Yes, it is.
Your favorite Supreme Court justice named just Antonin Scalia was very a big proponent of the right to confront your accuser. The article says, some worry the proposal could hinder a defendant's right in court.
Well, it's the radical left pushing back. The funny thing is, the radical left is in alignment with the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia that you just mentioned, who staunchly protected the Confrontation Clause and defended it through his entire judicial career. So maybe sometimes the liberals and the right-wingers are in alignment.
The Iowa House approved the measure last week, and it passed the Senate in March, though it would take years and several more votes by lawmakers and the public before the state constitution could be changed. Why is this an issue now?
Well, apparently the issue stems from a state Supreme Court decision last year that said Iowa constitution requires people accused of a crime and the trial witness testifying against them to see each other. What a concept. That's kind of what the constitution says. Holy mackerel.
Now, does that literally mean see, as in the exact same room? You couldn't do this what would be the word where you under oath, but you're just being interrogated by the attorney? What's that called?
Well, I get what you're saying, but we have to interpret things the way it would have been understood at the time. Remember, this is the Scalia doctrine. There would not have been any closed circuit video. There would not have been that. So when they composed this language, they never would have thought of you not being anything but coming into court and testifying in person. No one would have ever fathomed this. So magically, I'm in alignment with Scalia. I magically think that we should interpret these words as they would have been understood at that time. I'm magically a hypocrite when it comes to something that suits my purposes.
Yeah, someone tell me out. It's called a deposition. And so all of a sudden, you're a textualist and not, you don't want to have the law in the situation evolve?
I'm what it takes to win. And this, I want to win the protection of the Confrontation Clause. So I'm whatever I can latch my arguments around to secure the continuation of you being able to confront your accuser in court directly.
Trying to win the game.
All right.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd argued, "We are the only state that has come to that conclusion," said Byrd, a Republican. "It's really important that we can protect kids in court. That kids who have been traumatized can have the opportunity to testify outside the presence of the person that they may be very, very afraid of.
I can sympathize with that, but don't you think, for example, just say you're not a kid. This is off script, but let's just say hypothetically you're not a kid. Say you're an adult, and you're testifying against a gang member. Don't you think that maybe that gang or other members of that gang can come back after you? Don't you think that they're afraid as well? I mean, this is a part of our system. This is a part of our system. If you're trying to put someone in a cage, you have to go testify against them. But the
but this is also a significant burden, as we've all seen in every mafia movie, that if you go testify, then they're going to go put the meat, the muscle on you, and maybe your family gets hurt, and you wouldn't want your family to get hurt, would you? So then you don't go testify.
That's correct. But the amendment would say that constitutional right may be limited by law for certain witnesses, those under 18 and those with mental illness, including intellectual disability or other developmental disability. Both legislative chambers would need to approve this measure again in 2027 and again in 2028 to put it before the voters in November 2028. So it has a lot of hoops to jump through. You people in Iowa, if you don't like what you're seeing here, you better get to work, because this is going to become a part of your Constitution very soon in the next 3 years.
The Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution lays out the right of the accused in criminal prosecutions, specifying the right to a speedy trial, an impartial jury, and, among other things, to be confronted with the witnesses against him. Them. I pick them, Larry.
Well, except that's what it said. That's the way they wrote it in 1857 or wherever it was.
Women didn't even have the right to think back then.
So the Iowa Constitution was adopted in 1857, also defines the rights of persons accused, including the same confrontation clause. But the U.S. Supreme Court held in a 1990 decision, Maryland v. Craig, which I didn't know anything about this, that the right to confront accusatory witnesses may be satisfied absent a physical face-to-face confrontation when remote testimony is necessary and can be provided reliably. And that's what we've heard Scalia criticized. Maryland's interest in protecting child witnesses from trauma of testifying in a child abuse case is sufficiently important to justify the use of special procedures, that decision said. And the majority of courts across the country have aligned with the Supreme Court decision, according to Colin Miller, a University of South Carolina law professor.
The most common exception is when the state's confrontation clause includes the words face-to-face. That explicit text led the New Hampshire Supreme Court this year, for example, to say a 9-year-old girl's remote testimony violated the defendant's constitutional rights. Because, I mean, ultimately, don't the accused and the accuser have constitutional rights, and we shouldn't necessarily put one above the other?
The accuser has very few constitutional rights.
Oh, okay.
Those are invented rights.
You know, Fair enough.
Passed with statutory changes. The Constitution of forefathers put all the emphasis on protecting the accused, because we don't want to put people in cages without a robust process. But anyway, a 1998 state law carved out that exception for a minor needing protection from trauma caused by testifying in physical presence of the defendant where it would impair the minor's ability to communicate. Now, I'm not too stupid to understand that if you have a 9-year-old on a witness stand, that there's going to be some communication issues. I get that. But if the judge allows a minor's testimony could be televised to the jury and defendant in the courtroom, the only problem is that's not what they would have thought about back in colonial times. Iowa's confrontation clause does not specify face-to-face, but the court said still that it violated the constitutional right to confrontation, declaring that the state's constitution affords more protection to criminal defendants than the federal constitution.
The article points out that the amendment is supported by law enforcement and county attorneys, as well as various victim advocacy organizations, many of whom told lawmakers that justice isn't being served in Iowa if children are forced to face an abuser again and are too afraid to tell their stories. The thing that I sit almost daily, definitely weekly, and grapple with parents is when they have to decide, is the price of justice worth it for my child? Wendy Berkeley, a family advocate at Des Moines Area Child Protection Center, told lawmakers in January, unfortunately, right now in Iowa, the answer is they often have is no.
Well, and that's unfortunately one of the things that goes with our system. The opposition to the proposal has been concentrated, according to this article, among defense attorneys who cite examples of people wrongfully accused and say these allowances for certain witnesses signal to the jury that the defendant is guilty. That is a true statement. That's what jurors think. The existing law looks similar to the approach in many states, said Chris Wellborn, president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. But Welborn suggested that changing the Constitution is a slippery slope. They're basically futzing around with the Sixth Amendment, he said. I would argue that it's a dangerous road to go down, because when you start saying we carve out exceptions for someone's confrontation rights, do we also carve out exceptions for the right to present a defense? I mean, that's what's going to be said next. They're going to say, well, you know, all this stuff is really traumatizing the victim that the defense is putting on. So we need to shut this down and shorten the defense process. You know, that's what's coming next.
And Welborn's concern was echoed by Republican State Representative Charlie Thompson, who said the provisions open the door wide to mischief by future legislatures.
And let's give some bipartisan kudos, because this says that he's a Republican. But State Representative Stephen Holt acknowledged that the constitutionality concerns, but said the Iowa Supreme Court didn't offer any options. They struck it down, but didn't really give us any guidance on what to do, said Holt. They left us an interesting conundrum as we try to protect children in the courts against having them traumatized again. But they didn't give you the guidance because it's not their job. They tell you what you can't do, but they don't tell you what you should do.
And there is something to be said, forget the 9-year-old part, but someone that has some level of more maturity and faculties, that you're able to challenge them to the cross-examine and hold up on their story and try to poke holes in anything that's available that might be an inconsistency.
Absolutely.
So I win?
You win.
All right, cool. Let's go along. Now, you have this thing in here from the Marshall Project. What a bunch of liberal radicals. And it's from New York. It says, when New York corrections officers attack prisons and infirmaries, as has happened dozens of times in the past 15 years, I think we've even played some videos here about that, it is nurses who must document and treat the resulting injuries. Because you know for sure there's not a doctor in there. Their choices can save lives or cover up abuse.
Now, are you telling me that in a progressive paradise such as New York, that prisoners get abused by guards? There's no way that could be true.
It would appear that they do. A prisoner at Green Haven Correctional Facility in the Hudson Valley accused a nurse of medically clearing him to be sent to solitary confinement to cover up a beating by guards that left him with life-threatening injuries. A punctured lung, broken ribs, and a fractured hand. And you're just going to go sit in the hole? Come on, man.
Well, I don't see the problem with it. He should have thought about that before he got put in prison.
He should have thought about that before he went to prison. Right.
but all the nurses are not like that. Contrast that in nearby Sing Sing, a man credited a nurse with saving his life by yelling at an officer to stop beating him.
The article states how nurses handle instances of violence. Infirmaries gained wider attention in December when state officials released a body camera footage showing nurses peering into an exam room from a hallway while guards fatally beat and choked Robert Brooks at Marcy Prison. Nurse, oh boy, Abedin? Oh, come on, man, really? What in the world? Nurse Abedin and then I'm sorry, I cannot say this name. Sorry. The nurse, who works for a private nursing agency, stands outside an infirmary while corrections officers beat Robert Brooks at Marcy Correction Facility in December.
And the photo shows nurses looking on as guards beat Robert Brooks. Brooks died from his injuries the following morning. Such situations put nurses in a tough position. Those who witness abuse may stay silent about the abuse witness to avoid angering the officers who protect them as well as supposedly the inmates. Yet ignoring or covering up the assaults violates the nurse's professional code of ethics, prison policy, and the law. Now, isn't that a conundrum?
That would be. They probably don't make a super lot of money either. And then if they go rat on the guards, then they could put their job in jeopardy too. And next thing you know, then they're fired because they ratted out that someone was getting the shit beat out of them. The article states that in dozens of cases, nurses have been accused of helping to cover up beatings in New York prisons, according to the Marshall Project review of court settlements, disciplinary records, and pending lawsuits. The Marshall Project reporters identified 61 allegations from 2010 through 2024 of medical staff concealing evidence of guards' abuse, usually by foregoing examinations or not documenting injuries. During that period, the document fired just one nurse for neglecting these duties after a use of force, according to a review of state disciplinary data.
Did you say document or department fired? Just one.
Well, I probably misread it. During that period, the department fired. Okay, how would a document fire you?
Well, there was one documented firing. Maybe that's what you meant to say. Medical staff's propensity to cover up officers' violence happens more frequently than these numbers reflect, experts say. Many prisoners do not file complaints because they fear retaliation or not believe. Now, you've been in these settings. I've only been in county correctional settings. Would that be accurate in terms of prisoners don't file these? I would think it would be, but would that comport with your experience?
Yes, I would say that depending on the person and how much noise they want to make, they might just kind of take it and just accept what they can get and move on. As in not filing a complaint because, you know, maybe you were just lightly beaten, or maybe they were just, maybe they put you in the chains. I did watch this happen, Larry, this wasn't somebody being beat, but it was an old guy. And he was being put on a bus to get transferred to a new prison. And he's got the ankle irons on. And he freaking, like, face plants off the bus.
Wow.
And he's like, I mean, cat was, like, 70. And his glasses are then broken. So when you see him later, he's got, like, a black eye. And like, it's just shitty. So Commissioner Daniel, really? Another one?
I did this to you because I couldn't figure out how to pronounce it.
So that's Martucello, I guess. Martucello? I don't. Martucello. Martucello? I don't know. Has pledged to reform the culture in New York prisons. In a statement, he said he is working with the people and organizations inside and outside the department to make impactful change to end this violence.
Well, there is a violent culture in prisons. And it puts nurses in a bind. Experts say the primary duty of nurses is to support the health and well-being of their patients, according to the New York Nursing Board. And that doesn't change that because it's a prison setting. Yet prison nurses also feel a dual loyalty to the guards to ensure their safety, several former corrections nurses and staffers said. In this way, it's a blue wall that extends to prison life, to the prison clinic. It's similar to the blue wall. Medical staff go along these covers all the time, said Kevin Ryan, a retired internal investigator in the state prison system. If they want to keep their jobs, they have to go along. Now, that sounds somewhat eerily familiar to things that happened back in World War II when people did things that they did because they had to do them, and yet we think that that would never happen here.
Absolutely. So then in 2013, officers at Greenhaven Prison brought an incarcerated man experiencing psychosis to the medical unit to give him meds and draw blood. Video showed the handcuffed man talkative and standing normally, according to state records. Then the prisoner, strapped in a restraint chair, appeared to choke on water and pills and spit some out. Officers pushed his head down on his chest to put on a spit hood and severed his spine. God damn, dude. Like, how hard do you have to push someone's head down to sever the spinal cord? According to the report from the State Commission of Correction, video showed that his demeanor changed. Of course his demeanor changed. He was no longer babbling about in an almost listless state, according to arbitration records. Seriously, if you severed his spinal cord, I bet you he was like borderline, like, well, dead. Maybe not fully dead, but very dead.
I would think so. And officers carried the man back to his cell. Now, this is...
God!
This is so appalling to me. And video shows a nurse asking, are you hurting anywhere? Nothing hurts you, okay? So apparently she answered for him. Nothing hurts you. Oh, okay. Before leaving the cell, according to state records, the nurse didn't do a physical examination or take his vital signs. The man soon slid off the cot onto the floor and complained that his bones were killing him. I imagine he would have been complaining about that. He lay motionless and unattended for more than 24 hours before being brought to a local hospital. He died 3 weeks later.
The article states that the department fired the nurse for not examining the man and then telling investigators that he did. The state also fired a correction officer trainee who'd been observing the prisoner. The department did not attempt to discipline the officer or other medical staff involved. A prison spokesperson said the use of force was deemed to be appropriate. The nurse later testified at an arbitration hearing that it was Greenhaven policy to forego physical exams and assess an incarcerated person's injuries by asking him if he is not injured. And that's pretty much what we do. Other witnesses also testified that those actions were the norm at Greenhaven. Nobody speaks up for the abused.
That is so realistic to me, having not been there, but you're so powerless. You know, the fear of speaking honestly about assaults is widespread. And at Wind Prison, a nurse who witnessed a guard beating a prisoner in a wheelchair told investigators that an officer told her to say she saw nothing. She refused to identify the officer. In another case, investigators interviewed a nurse at Franklin Prison about an incident in which a guard broke a prisoner's jaw in the infirmary. She later testified that she received a call at work from someone calling her a rat. When she appeared at the arbitration hearing, she explained she was not testifying voluntarily, but was being forced by subpoena.
And I'm sure in your breadth of knowledge, you have a solution for us here.
Well, I really don't. There isn't one. This is the human behavior and the condition that we have. And if we could be very selective about who we put in prisons, your job is only to confine these people. You're not the judge. You're not the jury. You're not all these things that you want to be. Your job is to keep them confined until they're allowed to be released. And if you think your job is greater than that, if you think you should be the one who administers justice, you should run for district attorney. You should become a prosecutor. You should run for judge. You should do any number of things. But your job as a prison guard is not to decide what you think is appropriate and what these people deserve. Your job is to confine them.
Just to play devil's advocate, I have seen some insanely large humans and very violent people in prison. And guards come in all shapes and sizes. They're not all donut-eating 400-pounders. Some of them are pretty narrow dudes, and certainly many of them are women. How, like, you would have to employ some extreme measures to potentially restrain someone that has decided that they don't want to be restrained and rational. I mean, I can think of 25 different ways that you could handle this, but at the end of the day, somebody might not have all those resources available to them, and they decide to start, well, punching you in the face and breaking your jaw, as we just read.
Well, I would tend to agree with you on that, that prisoners have various levels of mental instability. They're hooked on drugs that are being smuggled into the prison, some by guards, and there's all sorts of volatility in prison. So I would never want to stop a guard from being able to defend him or herself. But on the other hand, the self-defense is one thing. Learning how I worked in my property management career in some of the most ghettoish areas that we have in the city. And I never had any problem to speak of, because I always treated people with the utmost of respect, even when they were losers. If I was evicting you, you never had any maltreatment from me, because it was not personal. And I tried my best to shield the uncomfortable situation that was happening to you from anyone else knowing about it, and treated people with dignity. When I was in the Boulder County Jail, I saw virtually no violence in the Boulder County Jail, because that was their operating procedure. They treated everybody with respect and dignity. And violence was so rare, you know, that when someone needed to be restrained, it was a very odd thing that happened in that county jail. So I don't say that I have all the answers, but I think having people that are heavily relying on their testosterone instincts to show that they're manly is not the answer.
I watched some cat. He was very mentally unstable when I first got locked up at the county jail. And he was just adamant that he wanted to drink the cleaning solutions, like the Windex. And he just wouldn't listen to the guards saying, stop drinking the the Windex. So they tased him. So then you hear the and then thump, and they carry the guy out.
Well, see, again, I don't know that I would have reacted that way. I don't know that I wouldn't have, because I'd have been in a situation, but he's only hurting himself at that point.
But isn't it still the responsibility to keep him from doing that too?
Yes, it is. If you are trying to find a way to stop him from doing it, it might be that just getting the substance away from him would be sufficient to stop doing it.
Yeah, he shouldn't be able to gain access to it to begin with. When they brought in the cleaning carts, he goes over to a new guard or something like that and asks him for it. He's like, man, you want to clean the windows? Great. Here's the cleaner. Go clean the windows. And they like, glug, 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 glug. No. That's not what I meant. Boy, do we have a fabulous incarceration system here. Hey, tell me about this thing with Harvey Weinstein standing a new trial. Is this like anything worthwhile?
Yeah, well, it hasn't been developed yet. I haven't even been following it, but they are going to put him on new trial. It's not already underway, but this is the article I put in for a couple weeks ago.
I know.
So he may already be on trial. I don't know what the status of that is.
And then he's still convicted in California, I think. So even if he somehow wins this case, he still has to deal with whatever happened in California, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's the other way around. I think he was convicted in New York, and then it was overturned, and California is waiting for him. They haven't convicted him yet, have they, in California?
Oh, I thought that... Well, okay. Something we need to cover then, because I thought that's what the deal was.
Yeah, we're eventually going to get to it, but he's going to die in prison. He's already ancient as hell, and the prison's not going to be good to him as far as any medical care. I think you kind of heard that in the segment above.
Absolutely. Yeah, they don't treat you well there. Well, very good.
He's not going to make it. And we threw this together because there's a good chance I won't be available next week. I'm getting a root canal Friday, and depending on how I feel, I may not be available. But there's 5 Saturdays in the month of May, so the patrons will still get their 4 episodes, even if I miss next week.
Is it 5? I thought we talked about there aren't 5. Let's see. 1, 2. Hey, there are 5. Oh, the 31st. Coming into the last... Oh, gotcha. All right, then.
So.
All righty. Well, make sure that you head over to registrymatters.co and you can find the show notes and make sure that you email any questions at all. And I will send them over to Larry. Registry Matters Cast. You know, we didn't cover that voicemail again. Registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And for those that are listening tonight, thank you very much. Thank you very much for being a patron. That can happen over at patreon.com. Oh, you know what? We did get a new patron. I got to grab that real quick. Head over to patreon.com/registrymatters, and then I will thank the new patron who was super generous. And what is that individual's name? I sent it to you, Larry. You should know.
Do you expect me to remember at 183?
I expect you to remember all of the things.
And I will tell you, because it should be in my text messages.
I believe it's...
It is Saddam Hussein.
I don't believe so. I believe that was Sammy.
So,
well, thank you very much, Sammy, for becoming a patron. Thank you very much.
It came in at the pandemic stimulus rate.
Yeah, stimulus was 14 and change, right?
Yep, and that's what Sammy did, was $1,400 a month.
And then we also have swag over at Registry Matter. Excuse me, that's FOIP Education. .org/shop. You can go find t-shirts and some cool things there, particularly the one of Larry, and then there's the one of the Kabuki machine. And without further ado, Larry, I bid you all adieu. I hope you have a fantastic weekend and that you have a nice cool air conditioner now, and boy do I hope that root canal goes well, because that does not sound fun.
Well, the whole story is not fun either, because I may have brought it on myself by being stubborn, but we'll talk
really?
About that another time.
You brought it on because you're stubborn? Never.
I waited and waited because I had pain and I thought it was going to fix itself, and it fixed itself all right to a big old abscess.
I bet. Well, I hope that goes well, and I will talk to you soon. Good night, everybody. Have a great night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.